Right, good evening. I'm very, very sorry for the tremendous delay, which for once was not my fault. I must join together with a few other thousand people who were all stuck on the motorway for 2 hours while some unfortunate crash was being sorted out with a helicopter coming to take away the injured, and so I hope they all have a refuah shlema. And it was interesting thinking about all the people on the bus that I was on, the coach, you know, each person has their own story, you know, what they were going to be doing in Oxford and why. But anyway, it is wonderful to see you and to share with you this idea of Bati Ligani. Bati Ligani literally means I've come into my garden. It's a phrase from the Song of Songs, chapter 5. And it is the name of a series of discourses in a most interesting way. There's the concept of a Chabad discourse. And in Chabad Hasidism, going back to the late 18th century, the key mode of communication of the Rebbe, the Hasidic leader, with his followers is through his Hasidic discourses, Kabbalistic Midrashic expositions. And for the seven generations of Chabad Lubavitch leaders, there are about 200 published volumes of these discourses. Right? 200 volumes of discourses. That's apart from other teachings, halachic writings, commentary on the Torah, Talmudic writings, She'elot u'Tshuvot, responsa, but of Kabbalistic Hasidic discourses. Now, I've called this the Bati Ligani by the last two Lubavitcher Rebbes, a literary edifice of the 20th century. So here it is in its two volumes, and I'm going to be explaining what these two volumes contain. Right. The final discourse by Rabbi Joseph Isaac Schneerson, who passed away in 1950, begins with this quotation from the Midrash on the Song of Songs. I have come into my garden, Bati Ligani, and then it gives a Midrashic exposition. We'll discuss which Midrash it comes from. For some 40 years, from 1950 to about 1990, it was expanded annually and elaborated in discourses by his son-in-law and successor, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who passed away in 1994. So in other words, you have the original discourse, actually has 20 chapters, four discourses, each with five chapters, and they're all expounding a continuous theme that's called a Hemshech, a stream of discourses, which is a particular Chabad concept, that each week the Hasidic teacher expounds something from the Sedra of the week, but in fact, the middle of his exposition, these middles all connect. And so that's called a Hemshech Ma'amorim, a stream of discourses. So we're talking about a stream of discourses by the Rabbi Joseph Isaac, which is then commented on year by year by his successor. Now, so here we have this in these two volumes that I have in front of me. I suppose more recent sets have the same color binding. I bought one volume in 1970 or 80 when it's a little bit later. Let's just see. This one is 1977. This was published 1977, and about 25 years later, this one was printed. So they have different bindings. So this is published in this form. Now, books, you know, how often do people look at books nowadays? Well, there are more ephemeral publications. This, called the Dvar Malchut, is a fascinating thing. Someone once referred to it as the Torah version of sliced bread. Now, people very often study the Seder of the Week, the Seder of the Week with Rashi's commentary. So this, which appears weekly, has got the Seder of the Week with Rashi's commentary. Many people study daily Maimonides, Mishneh Torah. So there are selections from Maimonides, Mishneh Torah. Some study three chapters a day, others study one chapter a day. Some study Sefer HaMitzvot, his Book of the Commandments. They're here. Some people study a page of Talmud every day, Daf Yomi. That's also here. And a whole lot of other material. I asked a friend of mine to try to find out how many of these were printed weekly, and he got the answer from, in Israel, 25,000 a week is the print run, and it's also printed the same time in America, a smaller run probably, but so it's over 25,000 a week. And so here, when it came to the 10th of Shvat, now I'll explain the significance of this date. This publication carried the discourse by Rabbi Joseph Isaac and certain discourses by his successor as well. So now, what is this, concatenation of discourses? What is it about? It's a grand récit, a meta-narrative. What is the meta-narrative? It's a view of the purpose of existence. The idea that the purpose of existence, the reason why the infinite oneness of God created the world, the finite universe, or many universes, beginning with spiritual realms and coming down to our physical realm, that it is here in order, it was created in order there should be a dwelling of the divine in the lower world. And so therefore the Garden of Eden is actually the prototype of what this is supposed to be. It's the image of what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be a world, a beautiful world, a garden. And in the garden are man and woman, the people, and with them is the divine presence. And that's really what it's supposed to be. But the sins which took place, eating from the tree of knowledge, Cain killing Abel, other problems which eventually led to the flood, the sin of the people of Sodom, things of this nature led to the divine presence being concealed. And the way it's concealed is described that it withdraws from the earth. It goes higher. It goes to the first firmament, the second firmament, further and further away. There are seven firmaments. So it goes to, it retreats to the most distant firmament. And then comes the function of the tzaddik, the righteous man. And with every righteous man, there's always a righteous woman. So there's Abraham and Sarah, and so on, Isaac, Rebecca. So Abraham begins the process of drawing the divine presence back towards the world. That's really, it explains the function of a leader, of a tzaddik, is to bring godliness down into the world, to reveal godliness in the world. And so there was a process whereby the seven steps that the Shekhinah had retreated was reversed by seven generations of great people. Abraham and Sarah is one. Then we have Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob. Jacob had a son, Levi. Levi had a son, Kahat. Kahat had a son, Amram. And does anyone remember who is Amram's son?
Moses.
That's right. Moses is the seventh. And all sevenths are precious, as it says in this discourse, quoting from the Midrash Rabbah and other places, which I'm going to speak about a little bit. And so Moses succeeds, first of all, in bringing the divine presence down, so to speak, onto Mount Sinai. But then that was only a temporary revelation of the divine. And then in the constructing of the sanctuary, now Nachmanides says the purpose of the sanctuary was to reenact Mount Sinai, but in a permanent way. So you have the sanctuary with the camps of the Jewish people around it in the desert, as described particularly in Bamidbar, in Numbers, the Book of Numbers, the way the camp was on each side of the sanctuary. And within the sanctuary, there is the divine presence. And so that is the moment that the Midrash, in Midrash Rabbah and in other Midrashim, describes as the moment when the divine presence came back to his garden. Ba'ati legani, says the divine, I have come back to my garden. And so that is the moment. And so there, the idea that is the grand récit of existence, the grand narrative of existence, that God desires to have a dwelling in this world. And what the discourse takes further is that the sanctuary is not only out there somewhere, the sanctuary in Jerusalem. The sanctuary was brought through the desert, 40 years in the desert, then it was brought into the land of Israel, and then it was rebuilt as the temple in Jerusalem by King Solomon. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and it was rebuilt later on, and then again it was destroyed by the Romans. There's also, it says in the Torah, in the section where it describes the duty, the commandment to build a sanctuary, it says, "V'asu li mikdash," they should make for me a sanctuary, "V'shachamti b'tocham," and I will dwell in them. Now, a number of Kabbalists in the 16th century, Reshit Chochma by Aliyah Devidas, and the Shlam by Yeshaya Halevi Horovitz, point out that it doesn't say, I will dwell in it. It says, I will dwell in them. B'toch kol echad ve'echad, inside each individual. So the sanctuary is not only there in Jerusalem waiting to be rebuilt, it is inside every individual heart. And so what the original discourse of Rabbi Joseph Isaac does is explore the different aspects of the sanctuary in terms of the individual in his or her relationship with the divine. So the first thing that we find in these 20 chapters, so we have in chapter 1, we have the idea of revealing godliness. Just one second. We have chapter 1 is about the whole idea of the revealing of godliness by a person serving the divine. Sometimes that means self-restraint and the ability to enable this divine revelation to be expressed. Just by the way, I remember, I've got to mention, there is a translation of the whole 20 chapters by Rabbi Joseph Isaac, which maybe you have in the library here. Yes, it's here in this library. So the original discourse by Rabbi Joseph Isaac, the 20 chapters are here. Now, it moves in to the idea of the offerings. A central feature of the sanctuary and the temple are the offerings. That's offering a lamb, an ox, a bull. So what Rabbi Joseph Isaac explains, based on a teaching by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, his ancestor, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, in the late 18th, early 19th century, that the animal is inside us. We all have an animal. Now, it's the animal soul. Now, maybe this animal is a very gentle animal, like a sheep, which it's an animal, but it's very docile. Compared with an ox or a bull, can be more powerful and dangerous. And a goat, which sounds a rather problematic creature, louche. And we have to, now that's the animal in our soul, but there's also the altar with the divine fire on the altar. You know, the altar, when the altar was made, when the sanctuary was being dedicated, they put, this is described in the book of Exodus, no, in the book of Leviticus, and it's also described in the book of Kings with the temple. So when the altar was being consecrated for the first time, they slaughtered an offering and put it, prepared the meat and put it on the altar, and then fire came from heaven and burnt the offering. And it is said by the sages in the Talmud that for the in the sanctuary, the fire was always there on the altar, this divine fire. And when they were moving the sanctuary, it was a portable construction. And when they would take it apart, they would put a copper basin over the fire and it would crouch in under that copper basin in the shape of a lion. Ariel, that's one of the words why Ariel is a Hebrew term for the altar relating to this lion under the fiery lion. And so there is this flame in our own heart. It's the flame of the divine soul. And the flame of the divine soul consumes the animal dimension inside us, if we allow it, and transforms it into something which is positive and holy and good, so that the passion, the animal passion of the person, becomes a spiritual passion. Surprisingly similar to Freud's concept of sublimation, right? The libido is sublimated, in the sexual drive is sublimated into art and literature. So it's there in this Hasidic concept as well. Now, so, and then another theme in the discourse is that the sanctuary was made of atzei shittim. Now, atzei shittim, the word, these are planks of wood. Atzei shittim is usually translated acacia wood, something like that, or cedar wood, sometimes. Now, the word shittim is mentioned in the Talmud as relating to the word shtut, folly. And so Rabbi Joseph Isaac explores this concept, mysterious. The sanctuary is made of wood, which is termed with a term which relates to folly. And he speaks of two kinds of folly. If we imagine the line of rationality, one kind of folly is going below the line, doing something which is irrational in a negative way. That's what leads people into sin. The Talmud says, "Ein Adam over avera ela im kein nichnas bo ruach shdut." A person only sins if a spirit of folly has entered into him, and that's why he acts in that way. So that's the quality of folly going below the line, the negative folly, shtut d'klipa, folly of impure, of an impure kind. But there's also going above the line of rationality, and that's called shtut d'kdusha, sacred folly. And sacred folly means utter dedication, an intensity in a positive way going beyond what is rational, beyond what is normal, beyond what is expected, what is called mesirut nefesh, self-sacrifice. And doing that, that kind of approach to life, to relationship, to God, and to helping others around one, that shdut d'kdusha, that sacred folly, redeems, has the power to redeem the negative folly, which goes below the line. So that is another aspect expounded in this discourse. And then we come to the very nature of the planks of wood. Now the planks of wood in Hebrew are called kerashim, keresh. Now keresh is an anagram of another Hebrew word, sheker, falsehood, lies. So There are the lies of the world, the lies of worldliness, which can be transformed into the keresh, the plank, inside the Mishkan, inside the sanctuary. So our endeavor in life is to take the falsehood which is around us and sometimes inside us and make it into something which is holy. That is the way in which this discourse teaches this struggle, this endeavor, the endeavor that each person has in maintaining their own individual sanctuary. And in one of the chapters he goes into beautiful detail about the difference, how it is, what it means to make this to change around these letters and the whole nature of sacred letters and non-sacred letters, and the difference between a resh and a dalet. So, Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Agod, Hashem Echad is one, and the letter dalet written in the Torah is a big letter dalet. It's a dalet rabati, a big letter dalet. And there's also another verse, lo tishtachaveh lekel acher, don't bow down to another god. And the word acher, it's just like the word echad, but it's got a resh instead of a dalet, and the difference between them is the resh is a sort of a rounded letter like that, and the dalet has a little bit sticking out at the back. Now, the little bit sticking out at the back, he explains in this discourse, is a yud. A little yud at the back of the resh. And that little yud is the yud of humility. So the humility changes the resh into a dalet. And the resh is the negative letter. It occurs in this word, other gods. And the dalet is the sacred letter of Hashem Echad. Interestingly, both dal and resh mean poor. V'larash ein kol. So they have the same meaning as words, and yet one is sacred, one is not in this sense. And it's the addition of the yud, which is the humility. So that is in another of these chapters. And then he comes to the idea, starts talking about in the 10th chapter, the concept of tzvaot, tzivot Hashem, tzivotam, the word hosts, it's translated hosts in English. When the Israelites left Egypt, they are called the hosts of God, tzivot Hashem, or leaving b'tzivotam, by their hosts. Now that's in the Pentateuch. Later in the Tanakh, we find Hashem Tzvakot, Lord of Hosts. It becomes a divine name. There's this mysterious interplay. First, the Jewish people are called hosts, and then the divine is called hosts. And so that aspect and the different meanings of the word Tzava, host, it also can mean time. Yesh tzava ale aretz, in the book of Job, the idea that man has time in this world. Now, so this, and then the discourse continues through. Now, it's quoting various passages from the Midrash. So it begins off with a quotation from Midrash Rabbah, which tells us this this concept, this grand récit of the way in which God at the beginning of time wanted that there should be his divine presence in the world, and then it receded from the world, and then the seven tzaddikim, beginning with Abraham, brought it back, and finally Moshe the seventh succeeded, and so that is Bati Legani, I've come back into my garden. Now, then it continues, that's the first discourse. Then the second discourse has another passage from the Midrash, which is another verse in Song of Songs. Hayoshevet beganim, you who dwell in the gardens, chaverim makshivim lekolech, Friends are listening to your voice. And Rashi on Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, and also in the Midrash, explains these chaverim, they are angels. When you are sitting in gardens, and it might be foreign gardens, it might be gardens of other people, but you're sitting in Bate Knesset, in synagogues and study houses, and you're studying Torah, the angels, the chaverim, the friends come to listen to your voice. And with that he expounds the power of what it means, just simply the quality of fulfilling Jewish teaching. That's the way the sheker of the world, the falsehood of the world, is made into the plank of the sanctuary. The people gathering together, even when there's a threat, and nonetheless they are studying together, and the angels come and listen. And this concept tzvachot is linked with the Kabbalistic nature of this word tzvachot. You see, each divine name relates to certain sfirot. So tzvachot, which is in the plural, Lord of Hosts, that relates to netzach and hod. Now netzach, we have wisdom, understanding, knowledge, kindness, severity, mercy or tiferet, then netzach and hod. Now netzach, netzach means victory or endurance. And it's the power of endurance with which the person dedicatedly studies. It relates to the concept mesirut nefesh as well, self-sacrifice, like going beyond the line, above the line, the sacred folly. It's another version of that in the second discourse. That's the idea of this intensity of service of the divine. That is the thing which brings the angels to hear what one is saying. Now, that's a little bit, sort of a little bird's eye view of something from the first 10 discourses, and it then continues with further elaboration of the name Tzvachot, and then it speaks about the way in which the divine is infinitely beyond lemaila maila ad ein keitz, up and up and up, beyond without end. Ulamata mata aden tachlit, and below also without end, without any. So that's explored then in the third and the fourth discourse. Now, where does this discourse come from? In the life of Rabbi Joseph Isaac, it first appears very shortly after he had become Rebbe in 1920 in Soviet Russia, when his father passed away. And Rabbi Joseph Isaac, at the age of 40, became the new Rebbe. And he's there just after the Bolshevik Revolution. All the synagogues are being closed. Many rabbis are fleeing. And Rabbi Joseph Isaac is left trying to preserve Judaism in the land of revolution. That's the name of an article by David Fishman, published in Modern History, giving a very beautiful account of his activities. And one of the things he did was he took a map of Russia, and he had a group of Hasidim, of followers around him. He said, I want 10 men who are ready to dedicate their lives to preserve Judaism here in the USSR. And 10 men stepped forward, and one of them, of whom he writes much later in a letter, he says, as you might imagine, Bensi was the first one to step forward. Rabbi Bensin Shemtov was whom I knew personally, thank God, and who set up Chabad in England. He was the first one of this group of 10. And he himself had an area of Russia where he was organizing secret chadarim, secret study places for children, until he was arrested himself. Several of these people were arrested, some were tortured and killed. In 1927, Rabbi Joseph Isaac himself was arrested. And thank God this was commuted to expulsion instead of him being executed, God forbid. He was expelled from Russia, and he went to Poland for 10 years, and then to America for the last 10 years of his life. But in 1923, shortly after he became Rebbe, on two consecutive Sabbaths, he taught the first version of this discourse. And he taught it in such a way that it actually begins with the Hayoshevet Baganim, that the midrash about dwelling in gardens, and then later it enters, it quotes the phrase, Bati Legani, I've come into my garden. And there we can see the thrust of the discourse is to remain a Jew despite the communist oppression against Judaism, unfortunately very much ruthlessly carried through by Jewish communists, the Yevsektsia, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, who were very enthusiastic about elevating their Jewish brethren to emancipate from Judaism and become a member of the world or the Russian. The Bolsheviks were a bit sort of suspicious about other communist parties. So the Russian communist ideal. In 1939, Rabbi Joseph Isaac composed a kind of summary of these discourses and had that published. And it's interesting, just before the war, there it appears again. And in 1950, he organized. Now, there had been a transcript made by a student in the yeshiva. The manner of these discourses, right from the very beginning in the time of Rabbi Schneur Zalman, is that for the most part, the discourses were not written by the Rebbe. Sometimes they were, but for the most part not. But they were heard by his students, who had such a dedicated focus to his teaching that they could remember word for word a discourse that might take 40 minutes to deliver or more, and they could remember it word for word. It's an amazing feat. The greatest living exponent of it is Rabbi Yoel Kahn, who is just 90 years old, just celebrated his 90th birthday, may he be well, for many years. And he had the ability to hear not only one discourse, he could hear the entire teachings in a Hasidic gathering lasting several hours. He could remember it all, word for word. He trained a team of other people who could do that. An amazing feat. So one of the people in 1923 who had heard the discourse wrote it all down. A man called Sklar. And in 1950, Rabbi Joseph Isaac takes this transcript by Rabbi Sklar, now an elderly rabbi, but at that point in 1923, he'd been a student in the yeshiva, and he takes this transcript and he edits it into a final version of this 1950 discourse, Bati Legani, I've come into my garden. And the 1939 version already began with the words Bati Legani, and so does the 1950 version. We've got the idea of dwelling in gardens. That's the second discourse. And it was made into four discourses. And the goal of these four, the first two were published for the 10th and the 13th of Shvat, 1950. The 10th of Shvat was the yahrzeit of Rabbi Joseph Isaac's grandmother called Rivka, and the 13th of Shvat was for the yahrzeit of his mother, Sterna Sora, who had passed away in America. She'd come out of Russia and Poland, she'd traveled with him, and she had come to the United States in 1940, another miracle, getting out of war-occupied Europe. She had passed away. And then there were another two discourses, one for Purim, one for the 2nd of Nisan, which was the day Reb Shalom Dov there, the 5th Rebbe passed away, so that's the 5th, and then the 6th Rebbe, Rabbi Joseph Isaac, became Rebbe. Now, one of the things it mentions in this discourse is the idea of the 7th. No, right, so 1 second. So here he's issued these discourses. See, I've got this pack of notes, but I'm not actually reading from them. So Rabbi Joseph Isaac issued this discourse to be studied initially the 10th of Shvat 1950. On that day was a Shabbat. No, yes. Was it Shabbat or a Sunday? A Sunday, I think. That day was a Sunday, but Motzei Shabbat, he passed away. Saturday night, he passed away. So technically, it's the Sunday, it's the 10th of Shvat. So this stream of four discourses became, it was understood as his last will and testament. Now, who would become the next Rebbe? He had two sons-in-law, and some people thought this son-in-law, some people thought that son-in-law. There was once a discussion going on, you know, in the few months after he'd passed away, and there was the postman, the local postman, the Brooklyn postman, happened to overhear the discussion. He said, "I know who'll be the next Rebbe." And I said to him, "How do you know?" "It's the postman." He said, "Because one of the sons-in-law gets a big packet of letters every day, and the other one doesn't." So one of them people are writing to. And he's not acting as a Rebbe. He said, this is Rebbe Nachum Mendel Schneerson, who was the son-in-law of the previous, they're both sons-in-law. So he's the son-in-law married to the younger daughter, Chaim Mushka. And he said, "We don't need a Rebbe. The previous Rebbe, Joseph Isaac, he's the Rebbe, and we simply need to go in the way that he's directed. And if you want advice how to go in his pathway, I'll tell you that, but we don't need a Rebbe as such." Finally, there was, over the course of that year, there were pressures from a number of people. One of them was this Benzion Shem Tov. He worked very hard among the Hasidim, trying to persuade them. It's the younger son-in-law. He's the one. Like, it was the difference. The younger son-in-law, the older son-in-law. Normally, the primogenitor rule, you know, you would think the older son-in-law. No, it's the younger son-in-law. He was less conventional. The younger son-in-law, he'd studied in university in Berlin and in Paris. So he was different. He wasn't the normal cut of a Hasidic rabbi. But he, nonetheless... So various people campaigned with the Hasidim, many of whom were very open to the suggestion. But more difficult was the Rebbe himself. The Rebbe's old Cheder teacher came to him and said that people need a Rebbe. So finally, at the first Yahrzeit of the previous Rebbe on the 10th of Shvat, there was a Hasidic gathering. And the Rebbe was there, and he was talking about Hasidic teachings and the previous Rebbe. It's the 10th of Shvat, it's his Yahrzeit. But the mark of a Rebbe is to say a discourse. So there was a Hasid, a middle-aged man, who had studied in Lubavitch, in the yeshiva in Lubavitch. In fact, when he tried to apply to the yeshiva, he was turned down. And he didn't take no for an answer. And he went to the rabbi at the head of the yeshiva, the 5th Rebbe. He said, "Rebbe, I want you to accept me in this yeshiva. It's not just for me, it's for my children and grandchildren. Please let me into the yeshiva." And so he was let in. "You want so much? Okay." So he came into the yeshiva. And now we're 50 years later, 45 years later. And he's there in New York, and he's there with this Hasidic gathering, and he suddenly stands up, he says, Rebbe, a Rebbe has to say Hasidus. In other words, a mimer. So the Rebbe began saying this mimer, Bosi Legani. He began saying this discourse. Bosi Legani, I've come into my garden, Bati Legani. And he gives a particular emphasis on what it speaks about in the very first chapter, that it's the seventh one. Moses is the seventh, and all sevenths are precious. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was now the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, he says, we did not choose this, but we are the seventh generation. He said to all his hearers together, we together are the seventh generation. The seventh generation is empowered to bring about the fulfillment of the whole project of creation, and we have that empowerment. So that concept of being the seventh generation was something. And he told a story of each of the six Rebbeim before him, beginning with Rabbi Shneur Zalman. In the discourse, he tells a story of each of them expressing their quality of Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's neighbor. So the story about Rabbi Shneur Zalman is that it was Yom Kippur. He tells it very briefly, that Rabbi Shneur Zalman was supposed to be in the synagogue on Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre night, and everyone is waiting for this Hasidic leader, this famous Hasidic leader. Professor Emanuel Etkes just recently wrote a book about him. He said there are more letters to him, by him, and about him than any other comparable figure in that period. Now, Emanuel Etkes wrote a book on Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, on the Vilna Gaon, on the Baal Shem Tov, and on Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi. So he's covered all the boxes of Eastern European spirituality in the modern age. The Musar movement, the Mitnagdim, the Hasidim, and that was his comment about Rabbi Shneur Zalman. So Rabbi Shneur Zalman is there in the synagogue. He's not there in the synagogue. And everyone's worried. It's Kol Nidre night. Where is he? And finally they found him. Everyone had gone to the synagogue except a woman who had just given birth to a baby. And there she is at home with the baby, and she's hungry, and it's cold. And he chops wood, and he makes a fire on Yom Kippur, and feeds her the food. That's what that's what this great rabbi is doing. And he told seven such stories indicating Ahavat Yisrael, because at the same evening, apart from the discourse, he also said the sisma, the statement. He said, when you come to Rome, do as Rome does. It's really a quote from the Talmud. Azlat lakachta. When you come to a city, do as the city does. In this country, we make a statement, what we call today a mission statement. What are we about? The statement is love of God, love of Torah, and love of one's fellow. And you need all three together. You have to go to, you can't have two without the other. And so his discourse then focused on the first chapter, explaining the idea of being the seventh and the empowerment that is there in terms of being the seventh. He is the seventh after that line of leaders, the six before him, and his hearers were the seventh generation. It was not that he is the seventh, but that we are the seventh. Now that was the first year. Then in 1952, on the outside, and he'd now accepted the position, formally accepted the position of Rebbe. 1952, he again said on the outside, 10th of Shvat, which was a couple of weeks ago, he again said this discourse, focusing on the second chapter. And then the year later, 1953, focusing on the third chapter. 1955, he gives a talk on the fifth chapter. Now, the fifth chapter talks about Shtutit Ketushta, right? The folly, sacred folly. And in the original discourse, the example of sacred folly that's given is of a certain rabbi, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzchak, in the Talmud, in Ketubah, in the chapter Ketzad Meraktim. How does one dance before the kala? How does one dance at a wedding? And it tells the story about this rabbi who used to dance in an absolutely crazy way. He would juggle And he was acting in a way you wouldn't expect a rabbi to behave. A juggler, but not a rabbi. And the other rabbis were a bit concerned about this. But later on he passed away. And when he passed away, there was a great beam of light over his coffin. And they realized he was specially holy. And the rabbi said, you know what made him so holy? His juggling. And so, now that was, that's given as an example of shtutik dusha. And why is there such shtutik dusha? It is because at a wedding, ish and isha come together, aleph, yud, shi, and ish, man, the yud of the letter of the word of man, this is in Sota, daf yud zayin, and the isha, the hey of the name woman, the yud and the hey come together, it's the divine name. So the divine is being revealed. How can you recognize, how can you express your joy at this revelation of the divine at a wedding? And he has to do something extraordinary. Now, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe Menachem Mendel, the seventh Rebbe, he is expounding on this discourse. He's extrapolating from it. And he began explaining, from this we see the tremendous power of womanhood. That in the realm of Hishtal Shalut, in the realm of the downchaining of worlds, the man is higher than the woman. But actually the woman is higher than the man. And when you reach a higher level there, the woman is higher than the man. And in the time of Mashiach, the time of the Messiah, then the woman will be higher than the man. And Eshet Chayla Teret Baala, the woman of valor, is the crown of her husband, is higher than him. And with that, he is expressing the whole concept of the power of womanhood. And I believe it was in the same year he found, which I've only just this second realized with you together, Ein Beit HaMidrash Belo Chidush. In the same year, he founded the Lubavitch, what's it called? The Association for Women, the Neshei Chabad, Neshei Ubenot, wives and daughters of Chabad, of Chabad. Now, Bonnie Morris, a writer, a feminist writer, saw this as she wrote a book about the women of Lubavitch, and she regarded the founding of this organization as an absolutely remarkable step, empowering women in an incredible way. And I've only just noticed that it relates to this discourse. Now, you see, there were a number of activities that he did which related to the discourse. So, for example, another one was that in 1980, he spoke about this Tzivos Hashem concept in the discourse. That was in the spring, that was like January. And the next chapter also talks about Tzivos Hashem, the same concept. So in September that year, or October, Chag HaSukkot, in the Chol HaMoed Sukkot, I think it was, he introduced a youth club called Tzivot Hashem. And that youth club continues, and he showed what the design should be for the emblem of the youth club. Now, that youth club grew. I contacted someone to find out a bit more detail about it today. There are 7,000 children in this youth club, but it has a sister organization who have a more power of an outreach organization called Sea Kids, Chabad Kids, which has 65,000 members. That means people who occasionally come to an event, a summer camp, or this, or that, or the other, 65,000 people around the world. That's in an amazing way. So these things were being generated by the discourse in a mysterious way. And at the same time, the discourse is talking about the transformation of negative into positive, and the way that one should always see and the whole idea of love of one's fellow. So we therefore see that this is, I believe, I claim, and perhaps you would agree, this is a literary edifice of the 20th century, and it fuels the energy of Chabad, both the supporters and the detractors of Chabad speak about their energy. And it's to a great extent fueled by the consciousness, le grand récit, the grand narrative which this presents of the nature of existence, and that our role is together to draw down the Shekhinah and reveal it in the world. Thank you. Are there any
comments?
Maskimi.
Can I just go back to the, you were talking about there is a level and there's the folly above and the folly below.
I think you're absolutely right. The only problem is they are doing something which is spiritually dangerous.
Right.
So their attempt is an attempt based on love,
yeah.
But it goes it leads to their death in the same way. This is compared with the Arba Nichnasu Pades, four people who entered Pades, one of whom died of ecstasy. So it's the same kind of intensity, an ungrounded intensity. And perhaps that's the interesting feature that it talks later in the discourse about the radiance which goes up and up and up, but also which goes down and down and down. So one has to somehow, although one is reaching upwards, one has to have one's feet on the ground as well.
I have a question. Do you think this whole structure of discourse, Basalagani, is in its own way trying to draw on the idea of the Hemshech? The fifth Chabad Rebbe had this structure of Chabad discourses as continuations,
yeah,
from week to week and theme to theme. Do you think this was drawn on the same style, or was it a completely different concept?
Well, the original four are a Hemshach. The original four discourses by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. With the Rebbe's, that means the Rebbe's comments, you see. So there's approximately 40 discourses, each one 20 commenting on the 20 chapters, and then for the first 20 years, and then the second 20 years. And so it goes 1950 to 1970, then 1971 approximately to 1990. What happened before 1990 is that in 1988 the Rebbe's wife passed away, and after that he almost never said a discourse in public anymore. There was so the same thing happened with the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitch Rebbe, who was a very prolific teacher, but when his wife passed away, he stopped teaching discourses in public. So it's as if the wife is like a channel to bring this godliness into the world that is manifested by a discourse, and then it stopped. So that stopped in 1988, so 1989 and 90, there was no discourse. So that's why it's an approximate number. Now, whether they constitute a Hemshech together, I don't know. I don't know if anyone has ever suggested that. In fact, very often the Rebbe's teachings, you know, you can see the way they relate to each other. But so that would be an interest, because it would be a Hemshech a year later.
Yeah.
Like postal chess. Yes.
How many Hasidus the discourses?
Ma'amarim.
Yes, ma'amarim prepared.
How are they prepared?
Yeah. So he would just come and under the spur of the moment, probably not.
Well, you see. Yosef Weiss, Professor Yosef Weiss, Alav HaShalom, who was a teacher of mine at UCL many, many years ago, he wrote in an article a description of how a discourse was given that we have. I think it's from Rabbi Zev Wolf of Zhytomyr. Gives a description of how the Maggid, whom we take, we understand as the Mizritcha Maggid, Rabbi Dov Ber, taught his disciples, who were going to be, many of them were going to be Hasidic leaders themselves, how to say Torah, how to say a teaching. And he said, you should know that the Olam HaDibur, the world of speech, meaning the Sphira Malchut, is speaking through you. And when you begin to hear your own voice, you should stop, because that's not it. It has to be something passing through you. So this sort of ecstatic pronunciation. Now, for the Rebbe, I once heard it said that when the previous Rebbe was looking for a sons, young men, to marry his daughters, he wanted young men who knew 500 discourses by heart. Right? So presumably the Rebbe and his brother-in-law were both such candidates. They knew 500 discourses by heart. Now, when you know 500 or even a few discourses by heart, and you begin to enter automatic speech, what comes out is Hasidic discourse. You know, now, so to the extent that the Rebbe would prepare, would think through, the Rebbe would speak many hours at a time, but never use notes at the table. He never used notes. And after he passed away, a set of rishimot were found of him, which sometimes included talks he had given before he became Rebbe. But as I remember, nothing once he became a Rebbe. Once he became a Rebbe, his talks were milamayla. And his breadth of knowledge enabled him to quote everything. I mean, this is partly the fact that he's the Rebbe, but partly the difference between Eastern European knowledge of an earlier time compared with the later phenomenon. And I once heard a story at a conference in Jerusalem at the Zalman Shazar Center. It was a conference on the yeshiva. And someone who was the manche, he was introducing a session. And he told the story that someone came from Eastern Europe to Berlin in the middle of the 18th century. And he met with the prominent maskilim, who were all very learned men, Moses Mendelssohn, scholars. And they were discussing something, and one said, yes, it says something about this in the Talmud. And he went to the bookshelf and he pulled out the Talmud and he opened it and he said, yes, look here, this is... And this gentleman from Eastern Europe nearly had a heart attack. He wasn't used to people having to take a book from the bookshelf. Everyone knew it by heart. So the Rebbe was from that style. So when it's from that style, whether it's Talmud, Kabbalah, Hasidic teaching, it just flows. It's gist.
I mean, the Fitzchabad Rebbe used to write down all his discourses before...
Yes.
And the Alter Rebbe also, Tanya, he
well, the Rabbi Shneur Zalman wrote Tanya, but he did not write his many volumes of discourses. And although the Rebbe Rashab is one of the, and the Tzemach Tzedek as well, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote, and he wrote so quickly that the ink at the beginning of the page was still wet when he got to the end of the page. And people thought, they accused him, as it were, of writing Bahashba'at HaKolmos, a magic way of writing that the pen writes by itself. And it's true that the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote his discourses, which are themselves absolutely amazing. And the fact that he is able, and it's a long hemsheichim, hundreds. I'm studying one of them on the bus while we were waiting with thousands of people, and I was looking at chapter 401 of a discourse, and the writer, the Rebbe, he could say, as I said in chapter, 212 or something like that. Anyway, so what we can say is that it's very remarkable that we have sages and scholars who are bringing, in a sense, the traditions of pre-war Judaism into the present and enabling us to partake of this kind of mystical and spiritual and Torah dimension together.
So. Great, thank you.